Okay, the court calls U.S. v. Williams, 17-3071, and we'll hear from the appellant.
May it please the court. My name is Dan Hansmeyer. I'm with the Federal Kansas Public Defender's Office, and I represent the appellant, Trayon Williams. Can you hear me, Judge Kelly? A little bit? Okay. So the issue in this appeal is whether a Kansas aggravated battery conviction qualifies as a crime of violence under the guidelines of the career offender provision. And we've essentially made two arguments as to why it doesn't. One focuses on the mens rea of the Kansas statutory scheme, and the other one focuses on whether there's an element of force. So I guess I'll start with the mens rea requirement. Essentially, the way this court has interpreted these provisions for the last decade is that crimes with a mens rea of recklessness do not count as crimes of violence. Now, so we're essentially here asking you to reaffirm that principle, and the government is here asking you to overrule that principle in light of the Supreme Court's decision in Voisin. Now, there has been a case from this court, United States v. Pam, this summer that sort of touches on this, but before I get into the Voisin issue, I think it would be helpful to sort of explain to the court why we think Pam does not hold, has not overruled those cases. And I mean, the first reason Pam doesn't overrule those cases is because the case we're relying on, Zuniga-Soto, there's a footnote in Pam that says we're not overruling Zuniga-Soto. But beyond that, the statute at issue in Pam had a willfulness mens rea requirement. So I think it's sort of a hybrid statute as far as mens rea. There was a almost two mens rea. There was a mens rea of a willfully discharging the firearm, and then a second mens rea with reckless disregard for the consequences. So I think all Pam says is that a recklessness mens rea that is subsequent to a willfulness or intent mens rea doesn't mean that the statute comes out of the equation. And that's different than the statute in our case because we're dealing with just a statute with a mens rea of recklessness.
No, we're not.
Somebody's going to start.
You're dealing with a statute that has a mens rea requirement of knowingly. Now, you say that that there's a difference between reasonable certainty and practical certainty, and so that the knowing requirement in this state is that the equivalent of recklessness, right. But that is a step. Would you agree with that? And it's a step, frankly, that you didn't challenge in district court. You never argued, you never presented those two law review articles or argued in the district court that the way that the state defines knowingly is the equivalent of recklessness. Do you concede that?
I think that is true. I think the argument is different, but I don't think the government complains about it. So, I mean, I don't think that matters.
Well, forfeiture is discretionary, and we could regard it as forfeited. Even if, I mean, now you can say that they waived the forfeiture, but that too is discretionary.
I guess. It seems to me that, you know, if the government wants to get to the heart of the matter, I mean, there was an appeal waiver in this case. It's clear that the government wants to litigate the recklessness issue. They waived the appeal waiver for this issue, and they briefed only recklessness. So I think it's pretty clear the government wants this court to decide whether Voisin applies.
Okay. Well, he knows the answer to that question.
But I think if they didn't want that, they would have briefed these issues.
Okay. So let me ask you another question. Is there any case ever in any jurisdiction that is now you cited two law review articles, you haven't cited a case that says that there is a substantive difference between reasonable certainty and practical certainty, and such a difference that one is not what it purports to be, a knowing requirement, but it is reckless.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any cases that if we decide to go to the merits of your argument, are there any cases that support you?
Not that I'm aware of. I think we're just focusing on the language used and the fact that a reasonable certainty is not a practical certainty. I mean, I think it's that simple, that if you're practically certain of something, you're more than reasonably certain of it.
Well, you pointed out, and I'm sorry to close your time, but you pointed out that in Texas they have the same mens rea requirement, right? reasonable certainty as opposed to practical certainty?
I think there's like four jurisdictions that have this sort
of thing. Okay, but including Texas.
Yep.
And then in Hernandez, our opinion specifically looked to that Texas statute, which, as you point out, was reasonable certainty, and said that that is a knowing, that mens rea requirement involves knowing conduct, and that that is sufficient mens rea. Right?
I thought you were giving me a favorable question.
I wasn't trying to be favorable or unfavorable. Yeah. I was just trying to ask you a question.
There is an appendix. So Texas has, this is page 22 of the appendix. Yes, you're right. Reasonably certain.
So, that seems to be your problem with your argument on the merits. Is, I mean, we have, like you point out, we don't have any cases that specifically address it, but we do have a precedent dealing with a mens rea requirement for a statute that you point out involves a mens rea requirement of reasonable certainty, and it's our published opinion, and it seems to undercut your argument.
Yeah, I don't know if this was. I assume this wasn't briefed in Hernandez, though. So I'm not entirely sure what you can draw from that if the argument wasn't made. I guess our basic point is that it has to be something different than knowledge, because knowledge is practical certainty, and this is something different. And if it's something different and it's lesser, it makes sense just to say it's reckless. Now, I don't know, and I think we're sort of in this world, this Armed Career Criminal Act, violent felony, crime of violence world, where things like this that intuitively make no sense, like the Supreme Court keeps saying burglary statutes are not burglary statutes. So for us to say a knowingly statute isn't a knowingly statute actually isn't something that we can't say in this context. It's just the way it is. That's the world we are in. So I do understand that intuitively it's a hard argument to swallow, but I think at the end of the day there is a difference and it has to mean something, and we think our argument is as good as any that if it's not knowingly, it's reckless. So that's where we're at on it. I don't know if that helps.
Yes, thank you.
So I think the Voisin argument, so if we get past Pam involves willful discharge of firearm, this is just reckless. So I think Pam doesn't resolve this issue. We get to Voisin, obviously. So let me just start with the text. So I think it's really important, and the circuits, I think, have done a horrible job at this, at really understanding that 921A33, the misdemeanor crime of domestic violence statute, doesn't look like the crime of violence provision. So the language is use or attempted use of physical force, comma, or threatened use of a deadly weapon. And then it doesn't follow, like it does in the crime of violence context, against the person of another. It then lists the people who have to commit the act, so essentially the domestic abusers. So the language, I mean, these courts that are saying these are similarly worded, nearly identical, it's just not true. They're not similarly worded. They're not nearly identical. They do have the same types of words. They have use. They have physical force. But in context, especially when you're talking about overruling precedent, I mean, there's no reason why your decision in Zunigo Soto needs to be overruled in light of the Supreme Court's interpretation of a statute that looks different. Now, on top of that, what I think is helpful to look at is the structure of these provisions, these crime of violence provisions, and especially when you talk about a mens rea, because we know from Begay v. United States that the enumerated offense clauses are purposeful crimes. And we know that Begay interpreted the residual clause to include only purposeful crimes. And we know when we go to the force clause, we know attempt crimes are purposeful. They have to be specific. You have to have specific intent. And we know threats, there's a requirement of specific intent. So you can take essentially this statute that includes all of these different provisions. And if the government's right, every single provision requires intent or purpose except this one word, use. And we don't think that makes any sense as a matter of statutory interpretation. Beyond that, as I mentioned, what the Court of Appeals are ignoring, except this Harper decision from the Sixth Circuit, which says if we came first, we would have held differently, but the phrase against the person of another matters. In the misdemeanor crime of domestic violence context, There's no requirement that the act be done against any person. I think the plate-throwing example is a good example. You throw a plate, you do that recklessly. I mean, the spouse doesn't even have to be in the same room, and it counts. Here, the act has to be done against the person of another. So I think that's another textual clue as to why our argument makes more sense.
What's wrong, though, with the Sixth Circuit's Harper analysis that called into question that very point? In other words, as I understand it, they were saying, that the panel was saying, well, that's true. In Voisin, you didn't have against the person of another, but the rest of the clause does contemplate that there's going to be conduct that would be, in effect, directed against a person anyway. And that was exactly what they said in Voisin.
So I guess we might be mixing up cases. So there's a favorable Sixth Circuit case and an unfavorable case.
Right. I'm talking about the Harper panel where they called into question the Verweebe analysis.
Yeah. Okay. So that case says what I'm trying to say, I think. Harper says what I'm trying to say, I think, in that when you use force against the person of another, there's an intent requirement. It makes sense to read an intent requirement in there, as to where if it's just use of force, there's not that additional language that suggests an intent requirement. I mean, that's basically the argument. I don't think it's any more complicated than that. So there's those two textual clues. And then I think it's important, just to finish up, that Voisin, the thing with Voisin, and all of these 921A33 statutes, they go to the Supreme Court and the government makes this argument, look, if you adopt the petitioner's view of this, none of this, you know, there's going to be a whole swath of crimes in these jurisdictions that don't count. And they convince the Supreme Court to do something that's atextual. I mean, I don't think there's any argument that Voisin and Castleman are atextual. That's just, you're talking about elements and then you go to what necessarily is involved. That's not a textual interpretation. So I think what's lacking here is that same argument. The government can't come to this court and say the crime of violence provision means nothing if you don't adopt its interpretation. The crime of violence provision isn't going to apply if you don't adopt its position. And we know that because this has been the law of the circuit for over a decade. And people still get crime of violence enhancements. They still get violent felony enhancements. So that underlying reason why Voisin exists, that underlying reason why Castleman exists, doesn't exist here. And so we're asking you simply to interpret the statute as written. And I think when you look at the Supreme Court case law in this context and don't look at the misdemeanor crime of domestic violence context, that's what the Supreme Court does. And I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Okay. Thank you.
Good afternoon again, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Jared Magg for the United States. In listening to the argument, I'm trying to forecast how this Court could write a decision balanced against both Pam and Hammonds. Pam certainly undercut everything about Zuniga Soto. And certainly this Court, it largely abrogates Duran, because Duran was a 4B1.2 case. And so this case, while they do not believe that Zuniga Soto could not be overruled under the circumstances, I don't know that the Court could avoid overruling Duran if it finds in favor of the United States in this case, because these are 4B1.2 force clause cases. And under that circumstance, there really is no difference. But both Pam and Hammonds are published opinions that very clearly made, at least plainly stated, that Voisin is going to apply under the circumstances.
To the ACCA?
To the ACCA in those cases. But the Court has repeatedly said that they're interchangeable in respect to the force clause.
Yeah, let me challenge you on that. We have a lot of precedents, as you know, where we frequently say, well, we have this precedent, and the Supreme Court has suggested maybe that logic is not right, but that it doesn't contradict or is not contrary to our precedent, and that there's a way to reconcile the more recent Supreme Court opinion with our precedent. And we certainly have the First Circuit and the Harper opinion. I don't think I'm getting confused this time. I think it was with your adversary, where they do reconcile Voisin with a Kunigasoto-like precedent. In other words, I'm not really sure if we have two circuit panels that have said that it is possible to reconcile a precedent like we had in Kunigasoto with Voisin, that we can say that that Voisin is just contrary to that precedent.
I want to be responsive to the question, but I'm going to answer it in a roundabout way.
Okay.
You first have to find that recklessness and knowingly are the same to even get to that question. I think you appreciated, Judge Bacharach, early on that this is about knowingly. If you found that recklessness and knowingly were the same thing, then I think you could get to that bridge. But I think it's a bridge too far, because we're here with knowingly. And our position,
in other words, we don't even need to reach the Voisin issue.
Okay. And in large part because knowingly and reckless are not the same. I understand the argument that they need to make to get you to that point in time. But our position is that knowingly is separate and apart from reckless in the context that if the court felt that it did not need to get to overruling Zuniga-Soto, it could simply base its opinion today on the fact that knowing and reckless are two different standards. Nevertheless, as the court said in Voisin, a criminal act can qualify as a use of physical force whether the act is committed intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly. So Voisin doesn't make the distinction, because it's looking at, in this case, the fact that use is separating the volitional act from the involuntary act. So you have the volitional act and the involuntary act. But then you have the intentional act from the reckless act. And they're trying to separate those two. And Voisin seems to prescribe that. Now, I understand Harper disagrees with that. Verweebe, though, is the controlling precedent in that circuit. So obviously they're taking shots at whether or not that continues to be valid precedent. I think, you know, in many cases you see these kinds of arguments in trying to get the U.S. Supreme Court to take notice, and maybe at some point they will under this circumstance. But I think to get to your larger point, does this court need to get to the issue? Our position is no, it just doesn't. But if it does, this is the proper vehicle to ultimately overrule Zuniga-Soto, and certainly to overrule Duran, because Duran's on all fours here because of the 4B1.2 issue. Zuniga-Soto, of course, was in a different context. But again, the interchangeability of the laws, or at least the provisions of the sentencing guidelines, are interchangeable when it comes to this issue. And I think it gets a little bit too far afield to try to argue from their point of view that the language in each of the statutes, particularly with the misdemeanor crimes of domestic violence, is such that it just has no play at all into the world of 4B1.2 force clause or ACCA force clause because of the different language. It would seem to me that the courts would have appreciated that fact early on, and they haven't. They've certainly taken a step to say that Voisin clearly applies. And I think this court's opinion in Pam foreshadowed that. They certainly had the opportunity to say that Voisin didn't apply in Pam, and the court did not. Certainly had the opportunity in Hammonds to say that it didn't apply, and did not. So in essence, from the perspective of litigants in reading those two opinions, it certainly seems to be a full-throated adoption of Voisin under those circumstances. And again, it gets back to my original point. How do you write an opinion in this case, balanced against those two opinions, that somehow favors the defendant's position? Again, you have to get through the first step of finding that recklessness and knowing are the same thing. And our position, again, is that knowing is certainly a separate standard. I don't want to belabor the point. I think our briefs are fairly straightforward on the issue. Again, I think the point that we're trying to make is, and I guess to get to your question, and you asked the question, it's for me to answer, you know, we are very confident that voir dire applies here, that we have always been confident that voir dire. I think you've seen in a lot of our companion cases on these issues that we have relied on voir dire, in large part because this court has, again, given every indication that voir dire applies in these circumstances. So to the degree that we may have forfeited any issue, that may be the case. But we are all in on voir dire under the circumstances here. And we believe that this case is a proper vehicle ultimately to abrogate both Zuniga-Soto and Duran. And we would ask that the court affirm the lower court's decision in this case. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you. Mr. Hensmeyer?
Four points on knowingly. I guess Mr. Nag is saying that's the government's position, but it's not the government's position in its brief. Just to be clear, the government did not make this argument. I think it's bad precedent for this court to make the argument for the government. Judge Bacharach, you asked whether we had cases. If you look at the government's brief on page 16, it actually talks about a case, the Spicer case. And it quotes, it says, general intent, quote, may be proven by demonstrating intentional or reckless conduct. So I think the government supplies the case that in Kansas, general intent, which is knowledge, can be committed recklessly. Quickly on Pam. So this is what, let me just read you a portion of Pam and why I'm telling you that a statute with a willfulness requirement is different, and this one doesn't have willfulness. So this is what Pam says. A statute requiring proof only that the defendant acted...
You slow down a little bit.
Yes. Only that the defendant acted willfully and with reckless disregard for the risk posed by that act. So it includes willfully and reckless disregard. And then when you move... This is on page 1208. When you move to the next sentence, it says, accordingly, the statute's element of recklessness does not bar it from constituting a violent felony, comma, particularly as the statute requires the willful discharge of a firearm. So all Pam is saying is that when you have a statute that has an intent element, it doesn't just go away because you also have a reckless element. So Pam doesn't control this case. On voir dire and whether it has any play in this case, that's not the issue. The issue is whether you're going to overrule a decade of precedent based on voir dire. So it's not whether you're writing on a clean slate and you think there's a Supreme Court case in a different context. Should we use it? Does it matter? This is a decade of precedent that the government's asking you to overrule based on a statute that the Supreme Court has called a comical misfit to the one we're interpreting today. That's not enough to overrule binding precedent. And just the last thing I would say is I think our best case for this really does come down to Begay. Begay is a Supreme Court case. If you read it, it makes it very clear that these types of crimes have to be violent, purposeful, and aggressive. Purposeful. That's the Supreme Court. It's in this very context. If you apply that law, you'll send this case back to resentencing. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Again, I want to compliment both Mr. Hansmeyer and Mr. Mang. I thought your briefing for both sides was very good, as well as your advocacy today. Court is adjourned, subject to recall.